Let's introduce Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist. Martin, this week's been a little bit weird, particularly the last couple of days, with the question mark over Italy and Spain. Billions daily now are being wiped off stock markets in Asia, Europe and the United States. For how long?
Well, we're teetering on the brink of a major collapse. I mean, let's not kid ourselves, this is a very serious situation, probably the most serious we've faced since the Second World War.
So why is that? How have we come here to be on the brink? Surely we shouldn't be on the brink.
I'm just going to bang my usual drum, which is the deregulation of financial markets in the 1980s is the root cause of our problems. And I'm afraid that there's been no reality about the situation for the last 2 years. Whoever's been in government, everybody has bought into the idea that we've got to resurrect the private banking system, even though it's dead. The banks are effectively bust, and that includes Barclays, because they're holding loads of CDOs for the other banks.
What are these CDOs?
Well, collateralised debt obligations, in other words, these complex derivative trades that they've been building up over the last few years.
And that have been deregulated.
Well, exactly. The whole point is that deregulation has turned into a very, very sour situation for everybody. And once the banks were propped up in 2008, there needed to be some really serious leadership from the top, and I'm thinking here of the US president, to get to grips with what needed to be done. I mean, Roosevelt in the 30s, he said, give me 100 days and I will do what I can to try and solve the problem. And he got stormed in there and he said, Wall Street will hate me, but I welcome their hatred. Now, I'm afraid Obama has not been like that at all. He's been a very big disappointment. The deal that's just been signed in the US is actually a rather stupid deal, which is actually going to crash the economy.
But it's what you want. You were saying that's what you wanted last week.
No. The deal was just to keep. If they hadn't done the deal in the US last week, the economy would have crashed over the world. But what's happened is, with both the euro deal and the dollar deal, the markets have started to look for the weaknesses in those deals. Now, in actual fact, that doing the deals was just a way of preventing the house from falling on everybody's heads. But the house is still collapsing, even though these deals have put it off by, it looks like, the euro deal has lasted 2 weeks and the dollar deal has lasted, well, we'll see how long it lasts. Now, the fact is that those deals are emergency deals that you do at the very last minute just to try and swerve the car out of the crash. But we're definitely going to crash, one way or another. Yeah, that's always been coming.
We're coming up to the markets closing now and the weekend. We've had 2 days of massive falls, billions being wiped.
The real scary thing is that the Asian stock markets have caught the flu as well. That's what they were really worried about this morning. Are the Asian stock markets going to catch it? And they have.
Now, you're talking about this as a flu, as a virus. I mean, to what extent are the markets really that unstable that they can catch a virus and keep
the markets
over?
The markets are incredibly unstable and interlinked. And the fact of the matter is, since Mexico defaulted in 1982... The default of just one major country, and it could even be a smaller country as Ireland, can bring down the entire banking system. Now, it's absurd to have got ourselves into a situation like that, but this is the result of the deregulation of financial markets. The regulation of financial markets, which separated retail banking from investment banking, was brought in the 1930s to prevent precisely what has happened. But in the Clinton administration in the 1990s, repeal the Glass-Steagall Act under Wall Street pressure, and therefore they brought the investment banking back into retail banking. I know, Leslie, you used to be a retail banker, didn't you? That's what you used to do. And the retail banks actually are fairly stable and solid, and they always were. But we've now got contagion from this shadow banking market, which is and it's everybody's responsible for this, because we've all allowed this to happen. But I'm afraid we are in a very serious situation now. Nobody's quite sure what to do.
Leslie, as someone that's worked in banking, what are your thoughts about all this? Because it seems like there's this kind of thing out there called the market, which is almost like an animal. You're never quite sure how it's going to react. And the last couple of days, the market has been absolutely hitting the bottom.
It hasn't hit the bottom yet.
It's
starting to wobble.
It's now heading for the bottom. And I wonder what your analysis of this is and how you think it can be sorted out.
Oh, good heavens.
That's a big question. I just said nobody knows the answer, so why should Leslie?
The thing is, I'm giving Leslie the opportunity here, because most of us have never worked in banking. We've got no idea of how the actual money system works. So, if you were... You had George Osborne's here now. You had his mobile number on his holiday, wherever he is at the moment, maybe in the Mediterranean somewhere. What would you be saying to him?
Oh, right. Where do I start?
Well, I mean, yes. You've heard Martin's analysis. I'm just interested, as you, someone that's actually worked in banking, I mean, how do you see all this going? Because we can't just simply be at the mercy of the markets. That's not good enough, is it?
No, we can't. And it is the investment banking side of it that's caused all the problems, as Martin has said. the euro as well has caused a lot of the problems,
mm-hmm.
because an awful lot of countries fudged statistics to get into the euro, and that's the one thing that I can thank Gordon Brown for, not much, but one thing, mm-hmm. is that he didn't take us into it. So now we're now looking at countries like Greece and Spain and people and Italy that did fudge their responsibilities.
Well, the obvious thing to say at that point is pretty surely we need protectionism but this is not what the markets want, and this is not what we're being told, you know, the free market wants. That is to put up a sort of financial wall around the pound and around Britain and to say, well, hang on a minute, we're just going to manage our own affairs, let these other currencies go where they want, but we're going to manage the pound.
And I'm not quite sure in the big scheme of things how easy or even possible it would be to do that.
Martin, what do you think? Is that likely or not?
Well, no. Well, you can see that the FTSE 100 has taken a beating this afternoon, and that is because British banks are heavily exposed to the Eurozone countries.
Yes.
So, I mean, Britain is one of probably the second most important financial centre in the world after Wall Street. Everything that happens in the world outside affects us or affects the city. So we're very much at the front of the roller coaster ride. We're sitting in the front car, and we always have been.
There was a whole thing of the Eurozone and other markets in other parts of the world in the Observer last Sunday, and it was rather frustrating because they had every country in Europe was listed as what's going to happen to it, apart from the UK.
What's going to happen to us? It's delusionary for the UK to imagine that a crash in the Eurozone and a crash in America is a good news for Britain. That's absurd because obviously there are customers, we're all intimately linked to them. The British banks are exposed to all of the troubles that are happening. So gloating at other people's misfortune is a rather silly. We really are all in this together, and when it crashes, we're all going to pay the consequences. And Britain is on its own is unable to steer the world economy, but we do have a fairly influential voice. You know, we're fairly big players, and we need common sense from people about the situation. I don't believe, Leslie, and I'd say this to a Labour front bench here, isn't it? I don't believe that you can cut your way out of this crisis. You can't. Spending money doesn't solve the problem either. But if you're in a car crash, cutting your own throat doesn't stop the car crash. You just cut your own throat, and then the car crashes. And I'm afraid that we really need leadership from the US in particular. Yeah, we needed Obama to get a grip, and I'm afraid he is now politically neutered.
But that
by
isn't,
Republican
that isn't
Congress.
Happening, is it? And the other thing, of course, is that the IMF, we've got Christine Lagarde, is also in trouble now.
She's very much a Wall Street person.
She's in trouble now. She, like before her, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, he's been hit with this court case in New York. She now looks like, in the not-too-distant future, has got a court case against her coming up. So the IMF looks a little bit as if it's a little bit unstable as well.
It's not just the fact that the personnel of the IMF, it's the policies that have been pursued over the years. I mean, basically, we've had 30 years of free market fundamentalism until suddenly the banks have to be rescued by the government. And that, at that moment, when the banks are rescued by the government, we're not in Kansas anymore. The free market philosophy is dead from that moment. But as a commentator, Michel Chossudovsky, who's an economist in Canada, said last week, when the banks collapsed in 2008, they weren't nationalised. What has happened is that the state is being privatised to keep the banking system going. Now that is way, way the wrong way to go. The banks have been bailed out, and they've used the money that they've been bailed out with to then lobby for further things that they want with our own money. Now, at a certain point, and especially if it does crash, people all over the world are going to get very, very angry, and we're going to see political extremism of all kinds. You know, there'll be left-wing extremism, there'll be right-wing extremism. That's exactly what happened in the 30s, and that's a very scary prospect.
But to what extent is the pound cushioning us from the Eurozone and the dollar?
I agree with Leslie that we shouldn't be at the Euro. The Euro was one size fits all, and this was an accident waiting to happen. But the real problems are the Euro might have been viable under other circumstances had it been put together in a different kind of way. But we are where we are. If the Euro collapses, and I suspect it will, that could happen in the next week or so, that the Euro will basically collapse. But
Does that mean it splits into the old currencies?
I mean, even for Tory Eurosceptics, that's not good news. I mean, failure in other countries will wash back over us.
Of course.
Whether you know, if they get it wrong, then that has consequences for us.
Does that mean it splits into the old currencies like the dinar?
Nobody's quite sure
how
this works. I mean, people have talked about the idea of the Greeks going back to the drachma. The problem for that is that there has to be a the Greek central bank has to decide to go for the drachma with agreement with their own government and presumably clear it with the ECB and the European Commission, and then they've got to spring it on the market so quickly that people can't take all their money out of the banks in Greece, because that's what they'll do. Yeah, if you're going to have all of your euros turned into drachma tomorrow, you take them out as euros now. Yeah, and that then run, that starts a run on the Greek banks, which then starts a run on the British banks, which then starts a run on the banks. I stress what I said earlier: the banks are bust, and there's been complete denial about this. They're using Enron-style accounting, including Barclays, to pretend that they are making profits. If they had to mark to market all the junk that they hold, they would all be insolvent.
So
not just liquid,
Martin,
insolvent.
If these banks are bust, why can't the Treasury simply, if there's any shenanigans and problems from these banks, they could just take them over for nothing, surely?
Well, indeed they could, but that would require a political will and a vision, and that's precisely what we're lacking. The politicians are still playing the old game of, you know, let's mudge and fudge and try and come to a compromise about something that we've somehow stick our fingers in the dike, and we've reached the point now where we've been sticking our fingers in the dike, but the dike's going to break and fingers won't do anymore. And the real hope for change was when Obama was elected 2 years ago. If he had got a grip, we might not be in this situation.
Okay,
but I'm afraid he didn't.
All right, so you're saying there's no hope. But what I'm saying
is... No, I'm
saying
there's no hope. I'm just saying this is the situation we're in. It's
pretty is the hope then, Martin?
Well, the hope from my point of view is that once we have had a proper crash, I mean, the real free market right, the von Mises and von Hayek's and so on, and the von Mises Institute have been saying all along, we should have let the banks collapse. And as a left-wing economist, I've got a great deal of sympathy with that view. If banks go bust, perhaps they should just go down the drain, just like mining industries, just like car industries, whatever. But they've become a special case because they've made themselves indispensable. It's like being in a room with a suicide bomber with a suicide belt on. And they can destroy themselves and they can destroy you at the same time. So you just have to talk nicely to them. That's how we've ended up. But we should, I mean, as the Irish say, I wouldn't start from here if I were you.
There's plenty of other scandals. One in particular, the 1987 axe murder of Daniel Morgan, the private investigator, that has been a festering sore in the Met for 24 years, which they still haven't solved, which touches on all the issues that the phone hacking scandal touched on, and many more, and goes far higher up and spreads far wider. And yet, unlike phone hacking, which is now the subject, as you pointed out, of a public inquiry and many other inquiries, the Daniel Morgan murder is still being prevented from being aerated through a public inquiry, despite the efforts of the family to persuade the current Home Secretary that she should do so.
That was Michael Gillard, who's we're now working for the Sunday Times, and who, along with Laurie Flint, wrote the book in 2004, Untouchables, Dirty Cops, Bent Justice and Racism in Scotland Yard, of which only 5,000 hardback copies were made, now going for quite a lot of money second-hand on the internet. Michael Gillard there.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2.
Now, on the 10th anniversary of the September the 11th attacks in the US, as it looms, what really happened that day? Did the media spike stories that didn't fit in with their preferred version of events? We hear from a senior US Marine Corps veteran and former head of the US Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Alan Zabrowski, about who he thinks carried out the 9/11 attacks, and more importantly, why.
I began to have suspicions about what had happened on 9/11. About 2 weeks after the attacks, there were several discontinuities that made no sense to me whatsoever. The behavior on the part of some of the named terrorists, these 19 Arabs on four planes, running around flying schools like loose cannon, not having the pilot skills to fly the aircraft, no recognition for what they had done afterwards in their own area, their own community. And it struck me that for many reasons, none of the arguments that were being given for what they did made any sense. But I then immediately forgot about it until about 2 years ago. And then I came across a video which I found to be extremely disturbing. That video was an interview with a Dutch demolitions expert named Danny Jawenko. It concerned the collapse of the third World Trade Center tower to go down on September 11th. This was the 47-story World Trade Center 7, the third tallest building at the World Trade Center. Jawenko had never heard of it. Neither had I. And when you looked at the building, you saw that there was effectively no damage to any face of the building. It had not been hit by a plane. It had not taken major trauma from debris. and it went straight down into its own footprint in about 7 seconds in what was visibly a controlled demolition. And it was pretty clear that whatever those 19 named Arabs on four planes, two of them at the World Trade Center, had or had not done, they could not have had any possible effect on that third building going down. Shortly after that, I came across, partly out of my own curiosity, in a very extensive video, both of which I've cited, by the way, in some of my recent articles, which were taken on 9/11 itself from what became Ground Zero, the base of World Trade Center 1 and 2, the Twin Towers, involving police, emergency services personnel, newspaper and television correspondents, and you can see and hear secondary explosions at the base of the World Trade Center buildings. Now, planes impacting at 800 to 1,000 feet above the ground are not going to cause secondary explosions at the ground floor. And this followed over into other reports also there on September 11th about vans in the area, white vans. In one case, the van was picked up by police and people arrested at the access to a major bridge. The van was filled with explosives, and the two people in it were Israelis. In Bergen, New Jersey, same day, a van with several people in it had set up cameras. Before the first plane hit, they were filming the Twin Towers, and they were celebrating. High fives. It was a good thing for them. Residents called police. Police arrested them. All five were Israelis. What intrigued me, in addition to angering me, was that within days, all of these reports disappeared from the media. Most Americans don't know that a third building went down at the World Trade Center. Most have never heard about the secondary explosions reported by CNN, ABC, Fox, and others at the foundation of World Trade Center 1 and 2. None have ever heard about the vans. So I began looking at this very carefully, and one of the things that I began looking at was just what would it have taken for a special operations group of any particular nationality to have done 9/11, either by having taken control of the operation we have been told about, of the 19 named Arabs on four planes, or having run a parallel operation where you have four planes being hijacked, but there is another operation being done with those in concert. And I picked up three particular factors that would need to be taken into account. One was motivation, a second was expertise, and the third, the critical one, was access. Now, when it came to motivation, it's probably a very sad commentary on where we are in the world today, that there are an awful lot of countries and groups out there in the world that have either real or contrived reasons to hate America. It wasn't that way when I was a young man, but then many things weren't the same way now as they were when I was a young man. But almost all of the groups and countries that might want to do this only had a negative reason for doing it. They wanted to hurt us. The Israelis had a positive reason, and it's one that a number of their supporters had talked about from the 1990s on up, and what was called the Project for a New American Century, whose members included, by the way, later Vice President Richard Cheney, later Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and many of the so-called neoconservatives, most of them Jewish but not all, who came into the first Bush administration. Israel had a positive reason, and was get the United States involved in a war in the Middle East with a powerful, enraged, anti-Islamic strain within the American public, that they needed a catalytic event to produce this. They even talked about it in terms of another Pearl Harbor is needed to bring the American people into this fight. The second was expertise. lots of expertise out there. Bringing buildings down and controlled demolitions is something that almost any intelligence agency of any country in the world can do or can contract. There are many private agencies that do this. But one thing is absolutely clear. Neither those 19 named Arabs on the plane nor Al-Qaeda as an organization had the expertise, the technical expertise to do that. And there is one very clear proof of that. If Al-Qaeda and its affiliates had had the ability to wire even one building for a controlled demolition at the World Trade Center, much less all three of them, the so-called green zone in the heart of Baghdad would have been a pile of rubble. And it wasn't. But the last is access. The World Trade Center security was an Israeli-owned company. Security at all three of the airports from which the four aircraft on 9/11 departed, ICTS, was an Israeli security company. That security company, by the way, also had security at the airports in Paris and Amsterdam later, from which the so-called shoe and underwear bombers departed. The security company at the World Trade Center had 24/7 state-of-the-art electronic surveillance and foot patrols. Wiring a building for a controlled demolition, and I must confess here, this is not my specialty. I have heard what people who do this for a living have said about it, but it is not my specialty. But the description of it and the video of Danny Jawenko that I mentioned to you is a very good one on this. And he described it in which if you needed to do it in a few hours, you would need 30 to 40 people, fewer if you had more time, cutting open the walls, literally cutting open the walls, all the way around the building, implanting the explosives, running detonator cord and cable, wires to put them to a control system, coordinating all of this activity. This is not something that involves the casual bringing in of a briefcase and leaving it at the foot of a building's elevator and going out again. This is extensive work, and it would require the type of extensive, sustained access that could not go unremarked by the security forces in place on this. They also needed the ability to evade apprehension and to have their escape concealed, and they had that done. All of the Israelis who were apprehended in those vans were later released in about 2 months at the direction of Michael Chertoff, then the second director of Homeland Security, a dual U.S.-Israeli national. There is no mention of them in the mainstream media, which is largely Zionist-owned. All of the major networks, all of the major national newspapers, all three of the weekly news magazines, all of the major political journals, most of the major publishing houses. It simply didn't happen. The only thing that happened on 9/11 that was discussed in the media, that would have been accepted by the government, that was described in the 9/11 commission, are 19 named Arabs on four planes bringing down two buildings. And the rest of it, in Orwellian terms, has become a non-event and a non-story.
That was the first of our clips tonight from Alan Sobroski. He's a former veteran of the United States Marine Corps and also, more interestingly, was for several years the head of studies at the United States Army War College, which is in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Now, Martin Summers is still with me here. Martin, you know, who is Alan Sobroski to tell us that it's potentially the Israelis being behind the September 11th attacks?
Well, one of the things that wasn't made clear in the clip, and people ought to understand, is that Alan Sobroski is himself Jewish. So he's a Jewish American officer. As I understand it, he was a US Marine colonel, served in Vietnam, and then was so senior that he was put in charge of training the US Army officers at the US Army War College. So you could hear the logical way in which he approached the whole problem. There's a lot of information there for people who they probably haven't heard before. As he pointed out, most people haven't heard that three buildings went down on the day. But if you check WTC7, just put it into your computer, and you'll see the video of the third building volume coming down. Now, when people see that for the first time, it often shocks them, because they say, well, why didn't anybody tell us about this before? And this is the whole point that Zabrowski's making. He's analysing it as a military operation, and he's pointing the finger directly at Israel as the culprit. Now, I've got an open mind about this. I think they must have had help from inside the US security forces, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to do it. Another senior military officer who's pointed out, well, I'll give you two other senior military officers in the world who've also said that it was an inside job. One is General Leonid Ivashov, I-V-A-S-H-O-V. He was Commander-in-Chief Russian Armed Forces on the day. And the other is Mohammad Gul, G-U-L, who was former head of the ISI, the Inter Services Intelligence Agency, the Pakistani CIA. Now, these are three senior officers, one Russian, one Pakistani, one American. It was an inside job, probably the Israelis. These are senior officers, military officers. They don't mess about. When they say what they're talking about, they say what they mean. But have you heard about this on Radio 4? No, you heard it first on Bristol Community Radio.
The other thing which I find quite surprising about that is that there's these private Israeli security companies running so many of these
Absolutely.
Airports.
They were running Schiphol Airport, where the underpants bomber was taken onto the plane without being checked by security. That's because the security is run by CTSC, which is the same Israeli company.
It's actually ICTS.
ICTS, sorry. I stand corrected. But the fact of the matter is that for those who use the internet and read the international press, this is well known around the world. The former head of the Russian Armed Forces is saying, as far as I'm concerned, that was an Israeli-American inside job. Has anybody told the British public that, other than ourselves and other similar organisations? No. The BBC that we were talking about earlier, Leslie said it had a left-wing bias. That makes me laugh, because they've said nothing at all about any of this, and have tried to ridicule those who've pointed out what everybody in the rest of the world has been saying for ages.
But many people will think of Alan Zabrowski as a conspiracy theorist, so how does he answer that charge?
I don't think that's so much of a conspiracy theory. To tell a bit of a story on this, back in the early 80s, when I was in Washington at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of our visitors for a luncheon talk was a young gentleman then named François Heisberg. Heisberg was the special assistant to French President François Mitterrand. I don't know how this subject came up, but he said, you know, Americans never see conspiracies anywhere. We French, he said, we see conspiracies everywhere. And both of us are wrong. This is not a conspiracy in the sense that it is usually used, the word is usually used, which is to denigrate an opposing argument. When someone in the United States says that that's a conspiracy or that's a conspiracy theory, by definition, they mean it is irrational, illegitimate, and without proof. All I would suggest to people is that you look at the films of WTC-7, that third tower going down on September 11th. You look and listen to the reports on September 11th with the secondary explosions. These are not fantasies. They happened. You look at the reports on September 12th of the apprehension of Israelis with vans of explosives and cameras filming the events on September 11th. These are not fantasies. And you look at the people riddling the American government, all of the Middle East people in State Defense and the National Security Council, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith, who used to be a friend of mine, by the way, from Philadelphia. These people were all part of the neoconservative movement. Many of these people are dual U.S. Israeli nationals. All of their primary allegiance is to Israel.
Is that correct, Martin, that there's so many people in the U.S. government who, as Zabrowski there is saying, is their primary allegiance is elsewhere?
Well, I listen very carefully to people of his seniority. And, of course, he is a strategic analyst. That's why he was head of studies at the U.S. Army War College. Think General MacArthur. Think of people of that kind of caliber. They are trained to analyze these events. He's analyzed these events, and he's come to his conclusions. I listen with open ears. I don't suppose the Israelis did it on their own, even if the Israelis are the ultimate culprits. But we've got a serious problem with corruption and terrorism inside the U.S. state structure. What do you do about that? Well, I don't know. That's another question, isn't it?
Well, you talked about Danny Jawenko in the first clip. He was an engineer and architect from Holland who was talking about the actual complexity of trying to rig three massive buildings with explosives to bring them down by controlled demolition.
Well, in other words, the key element here is access. When we had William Rodriguez visiting Britain and Bristol a few years ago, he was the janitor in the World Trade Center. Most people don't realize that the World Trade Center was privatized 6 weeks before the attack, and a whole new set of people were coming in and out who nobody who'd worked in the building for 20 years knew who they were. And the latest technical analysis of what happened, people have found nanothermite in the rubble. This has now been peer-reviewed in all of the chemistry journals by Nils Harrit, and who's from the University of Copenhagen, and Stephen Jones from the University of Utah. Basically, the bottom line here is that somebody had access. Who had access? Well, the people who owned the buildings. And we know who owned the buildings. It was a consortium led by Larry Silverstein, including one Rupert Murdoch Esquire. He was one of the consortium that owned the buildings, and he's been very, very supportive of Israel over the years. His recent troubles have led to all kinds of flurries of support in the Israeli press, because Rupert Murdoch has always been a great supporter of Israel. And a lot of these people, like Douglas Wolfowitz, Douglas Fife, all of these people, they are super, super, super supporters of Israel. Israel can do no wrong in their eyes, and they're prepared to do virtually anything to help them.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that every single one of Rupert Murdoch's papers was very much supportive of the Iraq war.
Indeed.
Anyway, Alan Zabrowski's from a Jewish family himself, and he's accusing the Jewish state of Israel of the most horrendous crime. So is Zabrowski a self-hating Jew?
My concern is that I don't much care about other people or other countries. I don't hate anyone in particular. I don't like anyone in particular. I'm an American. My loyalty is strictly to the United States. And I don't care what my ethnicity is or what my ancestry is. My allegiance is that. And my concern is only whether something helps or hurts the United States. And I think anyone who's a citizen of any country can very properly have similar feelings toward their country. What I'm concerned about is what is done to hurt America. And it is very clear that over a period of the last 40-odd years, that the penetration of the American political process, the effective subordination of the Congress in particular to Israel, when an Israeli prime minister can get 29 standing ovations from a Congress that can't give that much support to one of their own presidents, no matter how outlandish the statements, you have something as close to a puppet agency as you're going to find. Our policy in the Middle East has for decades been manipulated increasingly in terms of what benefits Israel and not what benefits the United States. Even when that policy is articulated and supported by individuals who are sworn officials of the United States government. And to me, when a sworn official of the United States government, whether or not that person has dual Israeli citizenship, manipulates American policy, contrives crises and tragedies like 9/11, contrives wars like Afghanistan and Iraq, and now tries to get us into a war with Iran, all in the service of Israel, spending American lives in that process, they commit high treason, and they need to be treated in that manner.
It's Alan Zabrowski speaking on Iranian TV channel Press TV on their Autograph program recently. Martin, this whole thing of the US being infiltrated by the Israelis, it does sound rather far-fetched, doesn't it?
Not really. I mean, quite frankly, they're there in plain sight. You talk to any American politician and they'll say that their support for Israel is unbreakable. Obama was saying similar things not long ago. They boast from the rooftops that Israel can do no wrong and they support her 100%, either because they're Christians and they believe that the end time is coming and the Israelis are part of their rapture philosophy, or just because they support Israel because they support Israel. The one of the few American politicians who said they didn't support Israel was Cynthia McKinney, who was the congresswoman for Atlanta in Georgia. And she was immediately attacked by the Israeli the Zionist establishment in the US and deselected in her district, even though she was incredibly popular. She's actually in Tripoli in Libya at the moment, or she was last week. Now, The Americans boast about their support for Israel, so in actual fact, when we say that American policy is dominated by the Israelis, it's hardly news, is it? It's not rocket science, it's been dominated by Israeli policy for years and years and years and years and years.
Now you talk about this whole idea of the sort of Christian right saying that the Israeli state is performing some sort of biblical mission. Now that's pretty scary, isn't it?
Yes, but I mean, we all know that we've got these rather scary people in the US who are Christians who believe the end of the world is nigh and Israel's going to bring it about, and many of them are elected to Congress, and the Senate, which is actually scary. But when you've got senior military officers saying exactly the same sort of thing, that Israel's defence is America's defence, I think it's really fantastic that an American Jewish officer of the stature and the intelligence of Dr. Zabrowski is prepared to call a spade a spade. He's a tribute to his training, he's a tribute to the US military, and he's a tribute to his own Jewish heritage, frankly.
Finally, Press TV's Autograph Show asked former US Marine Corps vet and head of studies at the US Army War College, Zabrowski, why pulling apart the 9/11 attacks is still important today.
I think the first thing to note, and I want to be sure that this is emphasized, is that Jewish nationalism or Zionism is not Judaism. It has nothing to do with Judaism. Many of the Zionists are very secular Jews. They are not practicing Jews in a religious sense. The thing that's intriguing about Zionism, and I think I use the phrase that it's a real witch's brew of xenophobia, ultranationalism, and militarism, with a nice scrap of regional imperialism built into it. Most nationalism is not like that. Most nationalism is intended to be a unifying force, but it doesn't go to such an extreme level. A second element of it is that when you have competing nationalisms, it's very, very rare to find anything that involves the level of antipathy and hatred to the other side.
Well, I think the distinction is between patriotism and nationalism. Patriotism is love of one's country. Nationalism is hatred of other peoples. I think Dr. Zabrowski is a great American patriot.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Froome Vale, Leslie Alexander. Also to retired Dr. Chris Burns-Cox and to patient advocate Daphne Havercroft. Not forgetting old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, we talk to more eyewitnesses to the Easter disturbances on Stokes Croft. What really happened there? This is Tony Gosling wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. On the internet, you can find us on the BCFM website and all our archives at bcfm.com.